It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
SmackDown sucks. It's almost as bad as Raw.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
This is episode 729 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off, and I am the Solo Monster here with you for Sunday, November 7th, 2021. It was November 6th, 2007, that I sat down to record the very first episode of the Sound Off. That was on a Tuesday, the day after Monday Night Raw, where Stone Cold used a hose to hose down Santino Marella. 14 years later, here we sit. What a journey it has been, and I have to thank each and every one of you who have stuck with me for the last 14 plus, well, not 14 plus, I'm getting ahead of myself here. I was going to say for the last 14 years, next year's a big year because next year we hit our 15-year anniversary. But to get to 15, you got to get through 14 first. So I thank you if you are still listening each and every single week to the podcast, or if you're brand new and this is your very first, welcome aboard, and thank you all for the continued support. Another week brings with it another round of WWE cuts. Talked about it live on YouTube the other night. We have some additional details on that. And for those of you who may have missed it, I got all the news on that coming up. AEW Full Gear is next weekend. And so we're going to run through the Full Gear card and do predictions. And I got some AEW news and notes as well. A bunch of really sad tweeting going on this week. So we could talk about that. A wrestling legend passed away this weekend, unfortunately, so we have a lot to get into here. First thing I want to do is thank everybody who dropped a PayPal, which, as you know, you can do on thesolomonster.com, right-hand side of the page. You will see the PayPal button. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out if you would like to be part of our PayPal posse here, like these fine folks. John Luis Cani Lopez. There is a name that you have heard a lot over the last 8-plus years that he has been listening to this show. John has been around for a while and has been a great supporter of what I do. So, John, if you are listening, and of course you are, I want to thank you directly here on the air for all of your emails and all of our conversations back and forth and all your PayPal support. The Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker Nayef Al-Safar, Killshot Keith Hart, Big Bear, Brian Becerra, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Evil Dose, Jeff Lippman, John Raging Mad Riffle, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Ostentatious Alan Carter, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, the Pastor of Pain, Damian Ewell, Powerful Pierre Degagne, and Sherrod, Big Daddy Boyd. Also shout out to Jessica as well. If you live in or around the Houston, Texas area, WrestleRave is coming to the Houston Premier Arena on Saturday, November 13th for its Chili Con Carnage event, Houston's first ever chili cook-off and pro wrestling spectacular. And they're going to be hosting a chili cook-off. There's a $20 entry fee for the contest, with the winner receiving a custom championship belt. On the show will be Jamie Senegal, who recently appeared on both the NWA Empower pay-per-view and the Impact Knockouts Knockdown show. Dante Leon from GCW, Deranged, who was part of the Special K faction in Ring of Honor many years ago. And the 1,200-pound showdown with Sam Stackhouse versus Angel Camacho versus Juicy Finau. Big Toco. So tickets are as low as $20. That's Chili Con Carnage, November 13th in Houston. I want to know who the judges are for this chili contest. If I was there, I would want to make sure I was standing at least 50 feet away from them. But that's me. And this Friday, it's going down. The time has finally come. House of Glory is back after 2 years, with its Born Again show from the NYC Arena in Queens, New York. This Friday, November 12th, bell time 8 p.m., The only tickets left are general admission for $20. First three rows were all sold out. JD from NY and myself will be on commentary live on Fight TV. So if you cannot make it out to the show, you can order it and you can watch it from home. We get to call what should be a humdinger of a main event. See, I'm just throwing words out there like it's 1985. A humdinger between Will Ospreay and the Amazing Red. A rematch from their Super J-Cup match 2 years ago. TJP defends his crown jewel title against Low Ki and Charles Mason. Cashflow Ken Broadway takes on New Japan's Rocky Romero, making his Hog debut. We also have Juventud Guerrera doing a meet and greet before the show, so come on down. I am looking forward to seeing some of you there. On the same day as their rosy third quarter earnings report on Thursday, WWE released 18 wrestlers. They announced revenues of nearly $256 million, which was up from $221 million this time last year, and $43 million in profits, which were down slightly, but that's not expected to be the case going forward. Regardless of these cuts, it's just the way certain expenses are falling in which quarter. So the bottom line is, the numbers are fine, but the cuts continue. And since April 15th of this year, WWE has eliminated about 70 talents. You could create an entire talent roster out of all the people that WWE has gotten rid of in the last 7 months alone. Almost all of them credited to budget cuts, which are with a few exceptions. There were maybe a couple of people who wanted out of their contract who ended up getting it. And there could have been reasons for a couple people here and there. But largely, what they have been told and emailed is that it's all due to budget cuts. We heard that with Bray Wyatt as well. Budget cuts. Even though we know that's bullshit. In June, it was Aleister Black. It was Braun Strowman. It was Ruby Riott, among others. In July, it was Bray Wyatt, who was legitimately a moneymaker for the company and one of its biggest stars. In August, it was Bronson Reed, who was never really even given a chance. He had one dark match, I think, or maybe a couple. Never made it to television. Had a very brief run in NXT as the North American champion. Brief, I assume, because it looked like he was coming up. He thought he was coming up. And boy, did he get knocked for a loop when he got the news. Some of the talent released was apparently due to them refusing to get vaccinated for COVID. And I guess not being big enough names to get away with it. Because there likely are other people on the WWE roster who are still employed, who are bigger names than some of the people on this list, who perhaps also would fall into that category, but their job hasn't been affected by it. But the issue, you know, when you think about the main roster, the way things are right now, maybe this will change. This might change next year, who knows, right? From 1 month to the next on the COVID front, things seem to always be changing. But if you're on the WWE main roster, you are, I don't believe, allowed to tour foreign countries without being vaccinated. And in fact, WWE, as we speak, is in the middle of a European tour. And I always see, one name I always see being thrown around on social media, and I don't know where this started. I guess it started from some posts on Instagram or Twitter that she liked or bookmarked or something many, many months ago. I hear Sasha Banks, her name being thrown around. Oh, she's anti-vax or she's a COVID denier or whatever. All this nonsense. And who, I don't even know where it comes from outside of again, her possibly liking certain posts or something. I don't care enough to pay attention to what post she's liking. But I laugh because I look at someone like Sasha Banks, who is a big name, and perhaps they would make exceptions for her in certain situations, but Sasha Banks, you know, is I believe, on the European tour right now. Sasha Banks flew all the way to Saudi Arabia. Sasha Banks is going to be at Survivor Series here in New York City, where they have certain requirements about who and who is not allowed in certain venues, whether or not they're vaccinated. And yet Sasha Banks is making all of these different shots. So clearly it's not an issue with her. Where this shit got started, I have no idea. But I am not going to sit here and try to figure out who is and isn't vaccinated, because guess what? I don't give a fuck. And there's no way to know for sure unless they come out and tell us. But I always see her name singled out But yet she's making all these towns and making all these countries and these tours and these shots. And I'm thinking, boy, you know, you would think if it was such a big issue and she was in that category, she wouldn't be making all these different events. But somehow, I guess she must be sneaking on, like, you know, the underbelly of the plane in the cargo hold or something. She's sneaking in there because she's bound and determined to go to these different places. And maybe WWE just doesn't know. But regardless of people's vaccination status, and not all 18 of these people on this list, this latest list, I'm sure, were unvaccinated. It sounds like the majority of them were. Even if they weren't, their vaccination status does nothing to explain shitty booking. Because I have seen some WWE fans who, you know, they just don't like it when people talk negatively about WWE or they immediately throw AEW in your face. Everybody speaks so glowingly about AEW. It has to be an even playing field. No, it doesn't. By the way, no, it doesn't. You criticize when there's a reason to criticize. Perhaps there's more to criticize when it comes to WWE than there is AEW in certain cases. But this thought never occurs to people. But again, you cannot use this as a crutch or as an excuse to explain away piss poor shitty booking of certain people. Stop making excuses. I always say it. Spare me the excuses. Because among the names that were cut this time were two former NXT champions, two men who found success under Triple H on the NXT roster and found nothing but frustration and pain on Monday Night Raw under Vince McMahon and Bruce Pritchard. Those two former champions are Keith Lee and Karrion Kross. Keith Lee is a man who built up a name for himself on the independent scene and evolved in different places and came to NXT with a lot of fanfare and went on to hold both the NXT and the North American championships at the same time when he ended Adam Cole's reign at the Great American Bash last year. You go back 2 years ago at Survivor Series when NXT had that really big night. They were included in the whole brand warfare concept. And that is where Keith Lee did that famous fist bump with Roman Reigns. Kind of gave him the nod out of respect. Had a really good showing, really badass showing at the Survivor Series. Of course, he also had a similar run-in with Brock Lesnar last year at the Royal Rumble. Had a little moment with him that not a lot of people had when he came out, you know, the look on Brock's face. The stories that Brock can tell just through his facial expressions is part of what makes him so great. But Keith Lee got that moment. Not everybody does. And so the guy had success as a representative of the NXT brand. And even initially when he got called up to the main roster, they gave him a win on pay-per-view. He had a six-minute match against Randy Orton and pinned him clean in the middle of the ring. And you thought, well, maybe they realize what they have in this guy. Maybe it is really off to the races with Keith Lee. Maybe he'll be one of those guys who actually crosses over and finds success on the main roster. Some people do. A lot of people do not. I had hopes that perhaps he would fall into the former as opposed to the latter. Didn't work out that way. Part of the problem was he got sick, very badly sick, with COVID. And so whatever plans they may have had for him at WrestleMania this year were derailed. I still think there was a pretty decent shot that he would have ended up with the United States Championship, and the only reason Matt Riddle did is because Keith Lee got sick. But we'll never know. But he got sick, and he was out for many, many months. Almost died. He has shared the story publicly. And so he came back and he was trying to get his win back and trying to get back in ring shape while they tried to figure out what to do with this guy. You look at a guy like Keith Lee. It shouldn't be that hard to figure out how to use somebody like him. What they were doing with him in recent weeks on TV is actually a great way to use Keith Lee. Forget the goofy name, forget the costuming and all the bullshit and the cartoony aspect of it. Keith Lee was going out there over the last 2-3 weeks. I mean, he wasn't on TV this week. Now we know why. But the last few weeks, we saw glimmers of what Keith Lee could go on to become. Big E right now is the babyface WWE champion, and Keith Lee easily could have been built up as a challenger in the next few months to the WWE championship. He could have won the WWE championship. I think the only thing that he was missing, and it's not a matter of like he can't speak, But I think the one thing that he was missing was a really good manager. Because Keith Lee should, you know what? The Keith Lee we've been seeing shouldn't be saying much. Let him be the strong, silent type who goes out there and throws guys around. If they could have found in another bygone era of wrestling, someone who could have been plugged into that managerial role to do the talking for him. And I'm not talking about Adam Cole, but the idea of him having a manager is not a terrible one. I think he easily could have been at the top of the food chain on Raw, and he could have been WWE champion. He could have had a legitimate run for himself on the main roster and would have been believable in the role. But he never had the chance. They never figured out what to do with him. So Vince McMahon said, well, I have a great idea. I know what we'll do. We'll give him a nickname. We'll call him Bearcat. And we'll put graphics on the screen that says Keith Lee clawing his way to Monday Night Raw. And we'll change his theme music and we'll put growling noises in there. I mean, think about what they did with Keith Lee for all that worked with him in NXT. Even the music when he came up, they changed his music. And maybe that had more to do with the whole, you know, CFO situation. And they were trying to phase down music of theirs from NXT. But, you know, this poor guy gets caught in the crossfire here because he had great music. They changed that. They changed his attire. They put him in a fucking singlet when he first came up. It's this whole idea of we have to make changes. I always heard if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But apparently that mantra doesn't really apply in WWE. They have to put their kind of stamp on it, on the main roster. And Keith Lee has since come out and said that the whole Bearcat idea was not his. Which a lot of us already knew. We knew exactly where it came from. It was never a case of him, you know, out of nowhere trying to pay tribute to Bearcat Wright, who I'm sure he has a great deal of respect for. Bearcat Wright, first African-American champion in wrestling. Talked about Bearcat Wright in some of the history segments right here on this very podcast. Bearcat Wright goes back to the 50s and the 60s. And I said this on my stream the other night. My God, Keith Lee, for as many years as he's been in the wrestling business, even before he came to WWE, and all of his time in NXT, and even when he initially came to the main roster, I never heard a fucking single word about Bearcat Wright. And one day, as they're trying to figure out what to do with this guy, all of a sudden, not only is he being called Bearcat Wright, but they're leaning heavily into the whole cat thing with the claws and the roar and everything else. And I was only half joking last week when I said, soon he's going to be coming out and they're going to put a fucking litter box next to the ring. It's going to smell like cat piss if you sit in the first five rows. Of course, it wasn't his idea. It was Vince McMahon's idea because in his mind, well, this isn't working. We have to gimmick him up. Karrion Kross. Here's another example of if it ain't broke, don't fix it, or at least give it a chance to fail before you do try to fix it. Karrion Kross got his release as well as Scarlett Bordeaux, who we never even saw on the main roster. Imagine having someone like Scarlett and not even putting her on television. Not even finding a role for her on TV. For a company that's all about appearance. For a company that's all about, you know, how people look on TV and presenting them and looking like a star. And all these beautiful people they put on TV and they put all the makeup on them and everything. They doll them up. To have someone like Scarlett Bordeaux under contract working for your company, and you can't figure out what to do with her, then you know you have a problem. Karrion Kross had a great act in NXT. Karrion Kross is somebody who, when you look at him, I believe, has a certain believability about him that not necessarily everybody has. He's got what I call the crazy eyes. You know, I've seen him cut promos before, even before he came to WWE. The guy's got something. When he was Killer Kross, I said the guy's got something. And I said he'll be a star wherever he lands once he gets out of his Impact contract because he was trying desperately to get out of that company. And eventually he and Scarlett both did. Scarlett got out first and then Kross got his release and he was a free agent, but not for very long. Because Triple H saw the same thing that a lot of people saw. This guy could be a star. I want to sign him. I want to bring him in. And so they brought him in, and yes, he's not going to go in there, and he's not going to have matches like Ricochet, and he's not going to have matches like Kenny Omega and people like that, and Bryan Danielson. He's a brawler. He's got size to him. He's got presence about him. He looks like a killer. Can't call him a killer in WWE, of course, right? PG product, so we'll call him Karrion. They bring him in, and they gave him this great entrance, the presentation of the Karrion Kross character, and him coming out together with Scarlett, and her singing the song, and coming into the ring, and the red light, and everything about it screamed superstar. It was the type of entrance that you look at and go, one day Vince McMahon is going to salivate over having an entrance like this in a big stadium at WrestleMania. And maybe this guy will get opportunities that your average guy won't get because he does look a certain way. Karrion Kross went from believable badass and champion on NXT with a cool entrance and a sexy valet to no valet with a stripped down entrance and being pinned in his debut match on Raw as the NXT champion to looking like a bondage gladiator to finally being fired. All within a span of less than 4 months. I must say, that is very impressive. When it comes to trying to break somebody down, I don't think I have seen as incredible an example of that as I have in a very long time with what I just described with Karrion Kross. Everything I just described is exactly the way it all played out. From the highest of highs to the lowest of lows in less than 4 months. And that was really one of the things that annoyed the shit out of me when they called him up initially to Raw. He was still the NXT champion. He was coming out with the NXT title strapped around his waist, being acknowledged as the NXT champion. And they beat him in his very first match. And that right there told you exactly what Vince McMahon thought of NXT. We already knew that Vince McMahon clearly didn't think very highly of NXT, because then it was only a few weeks later that he blew the whole fucking thing up. And now it's just a variety show every Tuesday with a bunch of random shit. But him coming out there and being the NXT champion and being booked and treated the way that he was on the main roster was such a slap in the face to NXT. Everything that Triple H had spent the last 5, 6, 7 years building, everybody who worked on that NXT roster. Because you know a lot of NXT talents had to be looking at that going, holy shit, this is what they think of us. This doesn't bode well for any of the ones who are still here. That's our guy. He's the face of our brand. He's our champion. And this is what they're doing to him. We don't stand a chance. Somebody on Twitter didn't even tag him. I don't even know how he saw the tweet. But somebody on Twitter wrote, wonder if Kross would give me the helmet. The helmet he started coming out in when they repackaged him weeks after first being called up to the main roster. And they said, I wonder if Kross would give me the helmet. And Kross replied to that person and said, nobody wants that piece of shit, brother. I can't wait for that shitty helmet to wind up on an episode of WWE Most Wanted Treasures in 20 years with Top Dollar fishing it out of a dumpster somewhere. That's where it belongs. Now, per The Observer, Vince McMahon had just pulled Kross from television saying that he hadn't gotten over. And within the company, they were told that they were going to be repackaging him for a third time. This man first got called up in August. And already there was talk of repackaging him for a third time. Remember that one week on TV where he was in the back doing an old Sean O'Hare type of promo. He even gave a wink and a nod into the camera to Sean O'Hare. And kind of portraying a character similar to what Sean O'Hare did many years ago. Where'd that go? He did that for about a week. Does that count as one transformation? I don't know how many repackagings this guy was in line for on this show. He only debuted in August. And already Vince McMahon had deemed that he wasn't getting over. Well, I wonder why this man wasn't getting over. I can't put my finger on it. Gee, I wonder why wasn't this guy getting over? I mean, this is the sort of thing I'm talking about here. You can't always lay this at the feet of the talent because in some cases they're powerless to do anything about this. Now, I don't know if Kross spoke up, you know, in a respectful way, of course, and voiced if he had any concerns. Here he is on Twitter calling the helmet a piece of shit. You have to know that this guy wasn't exactly thrilled about the way he was being used on the main roster. Did he articulate that to anybody? Did he ask to speak to Vince McMahon about that? Maybe we'll find out one day when he does that shoot interview, which I very much am very curious to listen to. It's going to be very interesting to hear what he has to say about that. But imagine, you're the new kid on the block. You just got called up. You don't want to make waves. You don't want to be a pain in the ass. You're grateful for the opportunity, man. You're on television. You're on Monday Night Raw. All you want to do is go out there and do a good job and succeed and become a star. And they cut his legs off from week one. Again, just kind of stripping the entrance down, beating him in his very first match. The helmet was just the icing on the cake. And I will never understand not putting Scarlett with him. Now, we heard rumors about they had other plans for her. They were going to make her a wrestler on the Raw or perhaps on the SmackDown roster and put her on a completely different show. You know, Scarlett could have been packaged with Cross and still wrestled. So if Cross was on Raw, Scarlett could have been part of the Raw women's division. I think initially the role for her was exactly the role that she had in NXT. You get them established together as an act, and eventually Scarlett can step into the ring herself and start wrestling matches. But to not put them together and not even put her on television, it was just, it doesn't make any sense. And yes, Keith Lee and Karrion Kross, for their careers, it's better for them to go off and go work other places and do other things, because clearly they were going nowhere in this company. But it still is aggravating, because it's not as if when I saw these guys in NXT, I was saying, God, I wish they would go to AEW. God, I wish they would leave this company. My only thought is I want to see these guys go on and become stars, because this fucking company needs more stars. They need new faces on television that actually get over and can be in the main event picture. They need that. Here are two former NXT champions who could have been that. I want to see them get over and succeed. And it's frustrating when they're not even really given a chance. And so then you have people clamoring to see them go to AEW or go to Impact, or not, maybe not Impact, but go to New Japan or some other company and, you know, get over there and kind of throw it in their face. But it shouldn't even be a situation like that. It shouldn't even get to that point. Fightful Select says the reboots of Keith Lee and Karrion Kross were not their ideas. WWE had looked at Scarlett as a wrestler on Raw or SmackDown, but she was quickly sidelined. And there were several people that pushed for her to be paired with Kross, but it never happened. Backstage rumors swirled of Kross getting heat within the company, but still several people tried to plead about the direction of his booking and his character. There were plans to adjust his character once more, but most within the company pointed to the booking as the issue and not the character. Something that I do on this show each and every single week. Because it is plain as day, all you have to do is watch the shows. And you see what the issue is. You see where the problem lies. You don't need backstage rumors and reports to tell you this. But to hear it confirmed from a source like Fightful, which is reliable, to hear that there are people who work behind the scenes in this company who see things the exact same way that we do, because they're not dumb. They see what's going on here. And again, they're powerless to do anything about it, because even the ones maybe who do speak up, nothing ever changes because they don't make the final decision. How many more careers are going to be ruined by this man? How many more careers are going to be ruined by people who do not know what to do with them? Nia Jax was released this week. There's something I didn't expect to come on here a week ago and report. Nia Jax was let go, and she later on issued the following statement on her Instagram page. I usually keep my personal life private, but yesterday's reports leave me with no option but to clarify matters. I recently took a short leave of absence from WWE for a mental health break. I've been working through so much, more than I can share, and so I took some time with the full support of the company to take care of myself. Earlier this week, after WWE sent me my schedule to return to the ring for the November 15th show, I asked for an extension to my mental health break, feeling that I needed more time and hoping I would have the ongoing support of the company that I have given my all for the past 7 years. I did not receive a response. The next I heard, I was being released. My vaccination status was never mentioned. I was not given any choices or options. It breaks my heart to be so abruptly let go without consultation when dealing with so much privately. I loved my career at WWE. I love the men and women I work with, and I'm going to need time to process this huge loss. I appreciate those people who have shown understanding and compassion during an incredibly difficult time. Now, I don't know what mental health issues she is going through, and I hope she works through it all and comes out better for it on the other side. But I will say what I said the other night. Nia Jax had no business being on the main roster. Nia Jax was called up way too soon. She was not ready to be on the main roster when she was initially called up. And over the years, she has not gotten all that noticeably better. And there are multiple instances of her either hurting people or almost hurting people or just sloppy shit that goes down in some of these matches that just makes you think, my God, she's going to kill somebody in there one day. We have had multiple instances and multiple examples of this. And what would have been great for Nia Jax, I think, is to have her go back down to Orlando, to have her back at the PC, trying to improve and hone her craft and get better, and then eventually make a main roster return. That is what I have said before. I stand by that. That is how I feel. I never said that the woman should be fired. I said that she should be sent down so she could improve and then eventually come back up when the time is right. There were a lot of other talents on that women's roster, or even down on the NXT women's roster, who were, you know, more than ready to be called up. I would put ahead of Nia Jax. Nia Jax overachieved. She got a lot of opportunities on the main roster and had a lot of success. In her 6 years or so that she was on television, women's champion, women's tag team champion, working programs and matches against all the big names, all the horsewomen, Asuka, everybody in between. She overachieved. Especially for her experience level. Where she ends up, I have no idea. I have no idea. But obviously it caught her by surprise. She didn't see this coming. And she's not very happy about being let go. B-Fab, another woman who got released by WWE this week. Hit Row is barely on television a month and already is down a member. It came as a shock because the belief is that she had just signed a new main roster contract in the last several days. Remember the comment I made on the podcast when I expressed my concern for the future of Hit Row when we found out that they were going to be called up to the main roster? And I made a comment, Vince McMahon is going to take one look at this woman, he's going to go, what the fuck is a B-Fab? That may be what happened here. Vince McMahon took one look at this group and their names on a piece of paper and said, B-Fab? What the fuck is a B-Fab? And then apparently didn't like what he saw. And that was the end of B-Fab. And so now Hit Row is down to three. Now B-Fab had a match on NXT. Might have been her last match on NXT before. They all kind of came up to SmackDown. She did not look good in that match. I think it was her against Electra Lopez. I didn't think either one of them, frankly, looked all that great in that match. But it was very clear from watching her in the ring that B-Fab is very green. She's very inexperienced. We didn't really hardly ever see her wrestle on NXT. In fact, that might have been the first time that I saw her wrestle on that show. So in the ring, she had no business being on the main roster yet because she wasn't ready. That's what NXT is supposedly there for, especially now that they've gone back to making it full-on developmental. It's the perfect place for someone like her to improve and get better and get more reps and get more matches in. It's tough because with COVID and everything, NXT just completely stopped running those Florida loops. Otherwise, she might have been able to go out there and actually wrestle real matches in front of people for a while before she got the call up. But ever since COVID hit, they stopped running those local shows. They were running shows in front of no people, and now they're running shows in front of, you know, 200 people or so at the PC. It's not the same as getting out there in front of actual people, even if it's a small crowd in a different building somewhere, just in the same state. They weren't getting those reps in, and I think people like her are hurt by that. But B-Fab had a presence about her. She was a very important part of Hit Row. Her voice, you would hear her voice, the first thing you would hear when they would come out. She had a stage presence about her. She was a big part of the presentation of that group. And Hit Row now is going to suffer without her being there. Now, I think Swerve Scott, he'll be fine if you just, you know, let him kind of go out there and do his thing. I don't want to see this kind of derail his career. Ashanti the Adonis. But already, this new act they call up to television. Barely on television a single month. And they've already eliminated one member of the group. Ember Moon. Gone from WWE. She tweeted, all I can do is laugh. She goes from NXT to the main roster, back down to NXT. She had some injury issues along the way, but she was also women's champion in NXT. Of course, on the main roster, the reason that she suffered that devastating injury, if you remember what happened, is I think it was on short notice. They called her in to be part of one of these goofy 24-7 chases, the 24-7 title chases on TV, where you come out there and you run and you chase after R-Truth, and as she was running back through the curtain, I guess maybe somebody was standing there that she wasn't expecting. She was running too fast. She had to try to stop herself. And she tore her Achilles, and she thought her career was going to be over. It was a devastating injury. She came back. She re-debuted in NXT. She was doing the tag team thing down there for a while. Apparently, they couldn't find anything for Ember Moon to do, so they decided to get rid of her. Another talent wasted. Eva Marie, gone from WWE. Eva Marie did about as much as Eva Marie was going to do. The minute they decided to make Eva Marie a wrestler and put her in the ring, that was the end of Eva Marie and what she could really contribute to that Monday Night Raw roster. Now, as a valet, as a heel who can go out there and get heat, I thought that was the way they were going with it when she first came back, the vignettes. I'm back because I want to help the next generation. It's almost like she was going to maybe lead her own faction of people. And walk around as this delusional person who thinks she was such a legendary wrestler. Yeah, I think that gimmick could have worked. But if the idea was to put Eva Marie in the ring and wrestle matches on TV, then you may as well just cut bait at that point, because that woman had no business being in the ring when you have other women who are not being given opportunities who can actually get in the ring and work. What do you have Eva Marie doing matches on TV for? So Monday Night Raw, SmackDown, whatever roster she would have ended up on, does not suffer because Eva Marie is no longer there. Eva Marie came in, she did the thing with Doudrop to get Doudrop established, and I could talk about that whole thing, but I won't get into it. That is the end of the era of Eva Marie. Mia Yim, one of those female talents that I was just talking about, who was just waiting in the wings, waiting for an opportunity that never came her way. She was going to make an appearance in the Women's Royal Rumble match this year, did not, chose not to, because she wanted to stay home and tend to her man, Keith Lee, who was very sick with COVID. So she missed an opportunity to be in the Women's Royal Rumble. She ended up, I believe, getting COVID herself, but has long since gotten over it and has just been sitting at home, I guess, doing nothing, twiddling her thumbs, waiting for a phone call telling her to come to TV and come to work. Or maybe she's been sitting in the back and catering, enjoying all the fine foods and all the great cold cuts they have back there. Whatever it is, she should have been in the ring. She should have been on TV. The one idea they did have for her, Retribution. What a wonderful idea. Their great idea for her was to put a mask on her, have her part of this, one of the worst angles that they have come up with creatively in many years on WWE television. And then on that one episode of television, start convulsing like she was going into some sort of epileptic shock. Remember when they had her doing that on TV? That might have been the last time we even saw her on TV. Her name has not even been mentioned. There were rumors months ago that internally her name was listed on the SmackDown roster and she might pop up there. Never did. Again, wasted. Wasted potential. In a women's division that really could have used somebody like her. Harry Smith, the son of the British Bulldog, Davey Boy Smith, was signed months ago, earlier this year. Kind of like a Johnny Ace project here. He wrestled one dark match in Houston at the very first SmackDown back in front of live fans in July. I think that might have been Money in the Bank weekend. He wrestled one dark match. He came to the back. He cut this 45-second promo for WWE.com or their YouTube channel and was never heard from again. He also got sick with COVID, but has since gotten over it. Supposedly, the idea was to make him a big star on the NXT UK brand, because obviously his father at one time was a very big star in the UK. In fact, his father was part of the main event in the biggest WWE show ever in the UK, back in 1992. But then he got signed, and the travel situation because of COVID was what it was, and so they made the decision that we'll put him on the main roster instead, except he never made it. He took a wrong turn, I guess, on his way to Albuquerque. His GPS malfunctioned. He went the wrong way. He took a wrong turn. And Harry Smith lost his opportunity to come back to the main roster. We never saw him one single time. I hope the money he made in the meantime was good. It's not bad work if you could get it. Get paid to do nothing? Grand Metalik, we know he had asked for his release because he had tweeted about it not too long ago. Grand Metalik was probably a very happy guy because he got exactly what he asked for. He got his release. Bryan Danielson is probably very happy too because he's always said the one guy he really wanted to work with was Grand Metalik. So all he's got to do is put a good word in with old TK, and we may yet get that Bryan Danielson Grand Metalik match in an AEW ring at some point. Lince Dorado, who I'm going to talk about in a second, he also got released. Frankie Monet, the former and now once again Taya Valkyrie, the wife of John Morrison, gone. Only a few months in NXT and already she has been cut. She tweeted saying, "I'll say the hardest thing for me to process after being released is realizing the amount of people that lied to me. Some of y'all should be ashamed." And perhaps one day we'll find out what those lies were. Someone who, yet again, this is a recurring theme that you hear me talking about here, never really was given an opportunity. I don't know why she went to NXT in the first place. She had enough experience under her belt to go right to the main roster. And in fact, I would have finally at that point, because Miz and Morrison were still a thing at that point, I would have started the Miz and Morrison split then, and I would have put Monet with Morrison. And again, she could have wrestled and did her own thing as well. I'm not saying she should have just been a valet and nothing else. But those two were great together, very entertaining together on TV when they were together on Lucha Underground. There's no reason they couldn't have replicated that on WWE television. But I guess maybe if somebody else did it first, well, we can't do it because it's their idea. We have to come up with our own ideas. Well, your own ideas are shit. There's your problem. Now they got John Morrison on TV sitting there each week in the back doing yoga poses. Namaste. He's sitting in the back. And Frankie Monet now is going to be sitting at home until her non-compete expires, and then she can get back out there and wrestle. Actually go and wrestle somewhere. Oney Lorcan was cut. Posted a video on YouTube saying that he has a 90-day non-compete, which is very odd because most NXT talents have a 30-day non-compete. Many of them have said they will be available in 30 days, but apparently he has a 90-day one, so we'll have to wait 90 days, and then I guess Biff Busick will be reappearing on the independent scene. Trey Baxter, cut. His girlfriend Cora Jade, though, still employed, still part of the NXT roster. Jesse Kamea, cut. Katrina Cortez, the first Chilean star in WWE. She made her debut 2 years ago on Monday Night Raw. She was wearing a lucha mask under the name of Catalina. I think they might have called her Catalina at first, but she ended up being called Carolina. She teamed up with Sin Cara in a mixed tag match against Andrade and Zelina Vega. That was the only reason, apparently, they called her up to TV. They needed somebody female to put with Sin Cara to face Andrade and Zelina, and they had no other plans for her. So after that, she was promptly sent back down to the PC. She tweeted the day after her release on Friday. She said, "At 18, I made the decision to travel to an unknown country without knowing English. I came here. Today, I receive an email telling me that my visa expires next month, and I will have to sell everything that with much love and effort I have achieved." And last I checked, she was putting up tweets selling her mask and some of her gear. So I don't know if that was instigated by her getting her release or if that was something that was already in the works where she was potentially being kicked out of the country. Obviously, if you're on a work visa and you lose your job, that's not good. So if you are an international member of the roster, and I think Bronson Reed had this issue, the Iconics had this issue, it gets very scary. Where your work visa is for a very specific, as I understand it, it's for a very specific either company or occupation. It's not like you can just say, well, just go work at fucking CVS or something until you find another job in wrestling. It doesn't work that way. I think it's a very narrow definition of what they're here for and what they're here to do. So when you lose your job, it can be very scary. And in her case, I don't know how much longer she'll be allowed to be here unless she gets that visa situation resolved in short order. Zeta Ramir is somebody who they had signed not too long ago. I think that might have been one of Booker T's students, but she was released, as was Jeet Rama, who lost to Solo Sikoa on Tuesday's NXT show. He is 40 years old. first debuting on the developmental show at the age of 40. So you knew his goose was cooked. But this makes five different NXT champions over the past 4 years, all gone now from this company. Andrade, Aleister Black, Adam Cole, Keith Lee, and Karrion Kross. And it seems to me that part of what's going on here is you have Vince McMahon, who is slowly erasing and eroding Triple H's influence, probably thinking less of him for two reasons. One is the AEW factor. NXT was not able to stop AEW's growth and halt their momentum on Wednesday nights. And in fact, AEW talent and Tony Khan, they were going around crowing about the fact that they beat WWE so badly on Wednesdays that they forced them to move to a different night. Now, there's more to it than just that, but the fact that they can beat their chest and go around and claim victory like that has got to just annoy the crap out of WWE. Triple H had one job, and he couldn't do it, right? And in his eyes, I could see him looking at it that way. But the other reason is their inability to create enough new stars, which they lay at the feet of the talent when they're creative, has never been worse. And if Triple H had never married into the family, I don't believe he would still be with that company anymore. I think he would have either left, kind of like Shane did all those years ago, go try some other things and eventually come back, or they would have gotten rid of him by now. It's not like they haven't cut other people in the company that have been there 20, 25, 30 years. If there was no familial tie to the McMahon family, if he was not married to the boss's daughter and gave him three beautiful grandbabies, I don't believe Triple H would still be with WWE at this point. I mean, they are just absolutely castrating this guy. At a time when he's at home trying to convalesce and heal up after having a cardiac episode, he has to watch what he has spent the last several years building be torn down brick by brick. It's got to be gnawing away at him. But we can at least end this discussion on a positive note. I said earlier, Lince Dorado is one of the names on the cut list. Now, you guys have heard of Izzy. Many of you, I'm sure, know who Izzy is. She was the little Bayley superfan from NXT who's not so little anymore. She was always at those Full Sail University shows with her parents in the first few rows. Her father, Cody, was in the news recently. He was accused of being the one behind all the booing directed at MSK in recent months, all because one half of MSK, Nash Carter, had the audacity to criticize Izzy taking a chokeslam bump in a match against Effie at an independent show when she was only 12 years old. That would have been 3 years ago. She took a chokeslam. Chelsea Green was another wrestler who was very vocal at the time about it and blamed her parents and the promoter of the show for it. And she has since tweeted about Izzy's father bullying her as well when she was in NXT. And guess who else spoke out at the time about Izzy doing that spot? Lince Dorado, who said, "As a parent and a pro wrestler, I feel embarrassed due to the actions of my peers. Not okay. To all of my friends who support the decision of a 12-year-old getting chokeslammed in a professional wrestling ring, that is your opinion. However, I do not agree and find that very disturbing." Fast forward to this week, Lince gets released, and there's Izzy's dad tweeting Lince to wish him good luck in his future endeavors with a smiley emoji at the end of it. You know this guy has been keeping like a hit list on these people for 3 years now. That's what's so pathetic about all this. Well, Lince responded to Mr. Izzy and said, "Don't worry, fam, I see you, at Cody Starbuck," which was, I should say, his handle on there. "I will be at Silver Spurs Arena today at 4 after my competition. Come down and talk. We gonna talk or what?" The competition that he was referring to was a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu tournament that Dorado was competing in. A competition that he won and he got the gold in. So, obviously, Mr. Izzy was quick to issue it. Now, this is before I think he actually won the thing, but it wasn't long after he tweeted that that Mr. Izzy was quick to issue an apology on social media, and he said, "Lince, no need to talk because I have truly already said too much. I am man enough to admit when I'm wrong. I sincerely apologize for my insensitive tweet on Thursday. Deleting the tweet is not enough. I owe you a direct apology. I also recognize and respect what you are dealing with professionally in this moment. I should have never made such a rude, off-the-cuff remark. Again, I truly apologize for my actions. You are a talented wrestler. I know that you will continue to thrive in the pro wrestling business. I want you to know that with sincerity. I do wish you and your family all the best. Hashtag apology. He actually included hashtag apology at the end of that, which made me laugh. Well, I guess Lindsay didn't accept his apology. Instead, posting pictures of a parking pass that he bought and a ticket to the show that he paid for. He paid for this himself. He paid for a ticket to the event and a parking pass and invited Mr. Izzy to come on down so that they could chat about things. And he later tweeted that the guy no-showed. So not only did Izzy's dad not accept Lindsay's invite, he deleted his entire Twitter account. I guess he also deactivated his Twitter after the MSK fiasco, but maybe this time he'll stay deactivated. The more I hear about these people, the more they sound like those stage parents from hell that you sometimes hear about. But I love that Lindsay invited this guy, who he clearly wanted to smack around, to a Brazilian jiu-jitsu tournament where he kicked someone else's ass and won the gold. I can't say that I blame him for not showing up. Maybe he should have sent Izzy to take his place. Poor guy now has to live his life watching out for a wrestler who wears a lucha mask and whose face he's probably never seen before. Lindsay's got himself more over on Twitter in the last 24 hours than he did in 5 years working for Vince McMahon. So from that, let's go to AEW and talk a little bit about that, because there was major news on that front. Before all the releases hit on Thursday, the big story was what happened with Jon Moxley. AEW had a monkey wrench thrown into its full gear plans on Tuesday when Tony Khan announced that former AEW World Champion Jon Moxley was entering an inpatient alcohol treatment program. Khan tweeted, "Jon Moxley has allowed me to share with you that he is entering an inpatient alcohol treatment program. Jon is a beloved member of the AEW family. We all stand with him and Renee and all of his family and friends as he shifts his focus to recovery. Jon is making a very brave choice to get help, and we are embracing his choice and supporting him however we can. I am proud to call him a friend, and like many of you, I'm also a fan of Mox, and look forward to a time in the future when he is eventually ready to return to the ring. Until then, thank you for supporting Jon and respecting his privacy at this time." The announcement came on the same day that Moxley's new book, called Mox, dropped, and 24 hours before he was scheduled to wrestle Orange Cassidy in a semifinal match in the AEW World Title Eliminator Tournament, which he was expected to win and go on to wrestle Bryan Danielson in the finals at Full Gear. But here's a man who had every reason to be on top of the world, on a professional level, on a personal level, on a professional level. Clearly, he's a lot happier now than he was in those last, you know, couple of years he was in WWE. That much is clear. And has more creative freedom and freedom on his promos and things like that. So he's in a happier place now than he was in, you know, 2 years ago. He was wrestling on GCW shows doing hardcore death matches that he apparently loves so much. He is the reigning GCW World Champion. So he was able to go out there and wrestle, you know, people like Nick Gage and other people and just have matches with Minoru Suzuki on TV and all these things that I'm sure he was just on cloud nine. On a personal level, besides being married to Renee Young, the two of them just had a child a few months ago, a baby girl. And it just goes to show you that no matter what, you know, externally we may be seeing and how happy somebody looks, you never really know what's going on a personal level and what they may be battling, dealing with, fighting against, whatever it may be. Nobody is immune to addiction. It doesn't matter how big of a celebrity or a star you may be. It doesn't matter how much money you have. You could be the richest man or woman in the world. It does not matter. You can still suffer from depression. You can still suffer from anxiety. You can still suffer from any host of different things. You could be sick. And if you don't have your health, that can really turn your world upside down. This is not something that only affects, you know, professional wrestlers or baseball players or football players. It affects all of us. And it probably affects some people who are listening to this podcast right now. You can relate even more than I can. You can probably relate to what that feels like. And he could have waited a couple of weeks, gotten through the match with Orange Cassidy, gone to full gear, wrestled Danielson. Even if he told Tony Khan, look, I'm going through this just so you know, when the pay-per-view's over, I'm checking myself in. So if he was going to win, let's put Brian over instead. He wrestles Danielson, he loses, and then he disappears to get himself healthy again. He could have waited. He chose not to. Even if it meant the timing was really shitty for him and the company, he recognized that he had a problem that couldn't wait. It needed to be addressed now. And he deserves a lot of credit for that, because I think especially wrestlers, as hard-headed as they can be when it comes to injuries and things like that, there's always been this mentality, and you hear it when they talk about it in like old shoot interviews and stuff, this mentality of the show comes first. And if you've got an injury, you kind of wrap it up and you deal with it and you tackle it later on. Right now, you got a job to do. Well, his job right now is getting healthy because he's got a wife and a child at home. And maybe that's what did it. Maybe that's what made him open his eyes and say, look, I have an issue and I'm going down a dark road here. I can't wait another day. I have a baby at home that needs me, that needs a father. So let's go get cleaned up. And I think maybe that'll be a great example for him to set for other people. But as far as his status in the world title tournament and his future in AEW, none of that right now is really all that relevant. Hopefully he will get better and he will get sober and he will come back and he'll be right back to what he was doing before. But that came out of nowhere. I think that was, outside of the releases, that was the most shocking news to come out of this week. Andrew Zarian of the Matt Men podcast reported that AEW is planning to hold its first quarterly TNT special on Saturday, January 8th. That is the same night as Impact's Hard to Kill pay-per-view in Dallas. We were told back in May when Turner made the announcement, they put the press release out, about Dynamite moving to TBS next year. In that announcement, they mentioned that they would still have a presence on TNT with four annual specials, one per quarter. This is back when Rampage was also supposed to be moving as well to TBS. Rampage hadn't even premiered yet. Rampage didn't premiere until August. But it was supposed to be both shows moving to TBS. Now it's only going to be Dynamite. But they announced that there would be these quarterly specials. Zarian said AEW is planning a TNT special on January 8th. They are obviously not able to use the name Clash of the Champions due to WWE owning the rights. However, I am hearing that possible name for this show will be Battle of the Belts. Battle of the Belts is a throwback to the NWA days. AEW filed a trademark for the name in September. Meltzer says the early word is that it would only be an hour long. So that would be 4 hours of AEW television that week with the first Dynamite on TBS that Wednesday, Rampage on TNT that Friday, and then the live special the next night. Actually, well, I assume live. I shouldn't say that because we don't know for sure if that quarterly special would be live or not. Could be something they taped the night before with Rampage. Dynamite ratings this week were not great. Relative to what they were doing a month ago before they got shifted over to Saturdays for those 2 weeks. The show did its lowest viewership in its regular time slot since July 7th. And now with TNT airing the show live on the West Coast for the first time these past 2 weeks, it looks like it's hurting more than it's helping. That will not be the case when they move to TBS in January. I don't believe the show will be airing live on the West Coast anymore at that point. We'll see if the number rebounds this week. But they may be in for some pain before they move to TBS. So Miro is the one who is chosen to substitute for Jon Moxley in the world title eliminator. He got a win over Orange Cassidy on Wednesday. It will now be Miro going one-on-one with Bryan Danielson this weekend at Full Gear. FTR beat the debuting duo of Aerostar, who I remember from the Lucha Underground days. And obviously Aerostar was much better off being on the taped show that could be edited than he was on the live show. He's a little rough there on Wednesday, but it was Aerostar and Samurai Del Sol, the former Kalisto from WWE, losing to FTR as FTR retained their AAA tag team titles. And Lince Dorado was not the only Lucha House Party member to wind up in the middle of a Twitter controversy this week. There was a situation involving Kalisto, involving Samurai Del Sol, where he wrote on Twitter, prayed and talked to John, and then in parenthesis he put Brody Lee, before my match. Thank you for showing me your home at AEW and giving me the strength and energy I need. I need it today. And then he put a praying emoji. Forever you are in my heart, Hermano. Jericho, later on, quote tweeted that and mentioned that you spelled his name wrong because he spelled John J-O-H-N instead of J-O-N. That's how John Huber spelled his name. So it sounded very petty when I first saw that tweet. I said, this is very odd. Why would Jericho be doing this? Obviously, it looked like this guy's heart was in the right place, and to call him out publicly like that for a spelling error seemed very bizarre. As if that wasn't bizarre enough, John's widow, Amanda, who is on Twitter now, concurred with Jericho. And people were saying to her, well, what's the big deal? He didn't mean anything, you know, negative by it. And then she was replying to people on Twitter, you know, that it's reasonable to expect that somebody would spell the man's name right if you name drop them. And, you know, somebody brought up Miro in the past has also misspelled his name. He wrote Brody, B-R-O-D-Y, instead of B-R-O-D-I-E. And she responded to that and said, first of all, Brody was a stage name, not his real name. And Miro spoke to me almost daily when John was sick. Miro cried with me after he passed. Miro continuously checked in on me and my kids. And what it seems like is that she was upset because she didn't really think that this guy was all that close to her husband. She wasn't like a really, like really good friend of his. And was just name-dropping him, and she had never heard a word from him the entire time that he was sick and then passed away. She didn't hear a single word from Kalisto. So that's really what it sounds like this might be about. They were upset that he was sort of, I guess, clout-chasing in a way and using his name in a personal way that, you know, he either wasn't close to him or just said nothing to her and the family when all that stuff went down last year. Now, if they know something we don't know, then fair enough. I'm not going to criticize his widow for how she feels, but I don't know that this needed to be aired out on social media. I mean, it just looks like Jericho tweeted about the spelling stuff as a way to kind of stick up for her, not because they necessarily really gave a shit about the way he spelled his name in a tweet. It's just a really lousy juvenile situation that probably should have been addressed with the guy directly, because if it really wasn't just about how he spelled the guy's name, all it did was get people attacking Amanda for being overly insensitive. I saw so many tweets and comments directed at her and tagging her, bashing her. And, you know, there's no reason for her to have to take that kind of abuse either. Not just Kalisto. So I just think the entire thing is just one giant sad tweet. Full Gear is this Saturday night live from the Target Center in Minneapolis. It does not look like it will be streaming on Fight TV here in the U.S. That was an option for All Out. I thought it was great. I would much rather stream the show on Fight. Only international viewers will be able to do so, though. The rest of us can get it on Bleacher Report or on traditional pay-per-view. Of course, if you use a VPN, like ExpressVPN, you might just be able to get it here after all. Or so I've heard. I mean, that's just what I heard. If only there was a link for you to sign up with ExpressVPN and get an extra 3 months free. Anyway, let's run through some early predictions. We still have a Dynamite and a Rampage left to go before the show, but this is the last sound-off before the pay-per-view, so I didn't want to wait any longer, so let's get into this here. There has been nothing announced yet for Cody Rhodes, for Malakai Black, Andrade, or Pac. I expect that either a four-way or a tag team match will be added to the show this week. We've got the Young Bucks and Adam Cole, the Super Click, taking on Jurassic Express. That's Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus and Christian Cage. I'm going to go with the Bucks and Adam Cole for the win. And perhaps coming out of this, we'll be able to get a singles match on TV between Adam Cole and Christian Cage. CM Punk, one-on-one against Eddie Kingston. If you did not see Rampage on Friday, do yourself a favor and watch the segment with Punk and Kingston to set up this match here for the pay-per-view. Those two guys went out there and they had a hell of a segment on a very short notice, trying to build up a match on pay-per-view. They went out there and I think they talked a lot of people who maybe were on the fence into ordering this pay-per-view just to see Punk against Kingston. And perhaps this won't be the only match these two have. Maybe this is the first of two. Maybe they'll have a rematch on TV at some point. But even if there is a second match, I don't see the outcome here being any different than what probably all of you expect. Eddie Kingston is in need of a big win. I hope he gets it at some point, but it won't be here. CM Punk is going to pick up the victory. But this is the first time since Punk came to AEW back in August. It feels like he's got a real feud. And again, it was only just manufactured in the last week or so on promos. Nothing physical outside of the pull-apart they finally had at the end of their segment on Friday. But even before the pull-apart, you know, the way it went out there and they, I think, talked a lot of people into being excited for a match that maybe otherwise they wouldn't have been excited for. But I think CM Punk is going to pick up the win. Hopefully not the only time we see these two in the ring, but it's a huge platform for Eddie Kingston, the biggest match he's going to have in his AEW career so far. We've got the Lucha Bros defending their, their AEW tag team titles against the AAA tag team champions, FTR, but only the AEW tag team titles, I believe, are on the line. I think it's going to be a very good match between two of the best teams they have on their roster. I think the Lucha Bros are absolutely not losing their titles back to FTR, who did hold them once before. But I don't see them dropping them here. I think we'll just get a great professional wrestling match between two of the best teams in the world right now. But the Lucha Bros are going to retain their belts. Darby Allin one-on-one against MJF, two men who both lost at the last pay-per-view. Darby lost to Punk, MJF lost to Jericho. So one of them this time will walk out with the win. This could very easily go either way. This actually is one of the tougher matches, I think, on this card to predict. I'm predicting an MJF win, especially because I think you want to start to set him up for a championship match at some point, maybe early next year. But I think Darby Allin could also very easily walk away with the win if they have a mishap between MJF and Wardlow. They've been doing the slow burn to an eventual Wardlow split with MJF. Maybe that next development happens here at the pay-per-view and it costs MJF the win. Doesn't really hurt MJF at all if that happens. Gives Darby a nice rebound win coming off the loss to CM Punk. But I feel like MJF is going over here. He would be the one I would put over in this match. I think he'll walk away with the victory. Dr. Britt Baker, DMD, defends her AEW Women's Championship against Ty Conti, who used to be in NXT and, surprise, surprise, was very frustrated because they wouldn't find anything for her to do. Usually that's something you run into on the main roster, but she had that issue in NXT. And she left and ended up in AEW and has improved a lot since we saw her in NXT. She is the perfect person to put in the ring with Britt Baker as an interim opponent. She is not going to win the championship, but she is the perfect person to go in there and I think give her a competitive match, what should be a good match, but Britt Baker is not losing this title. I have said it before, I will say it again, as much of a broken record as I may sound like, Britt Baker should not be dropping this title until she gets back in the ring with Thunder Rosa. They have not gotten back to Britt Baker and Thunder Rosa since Baker won that belt. You cannot take the championship off of her until you get back to that feud. We have a Minneapolis street fight, the Inner Circle. Chris Jericho, Sammy Guevara, Jake Hager, Santana, and Ortiz taking on the Men of the Year, Scorpio Sky and Ethan Page, along with American Top Team members Junior Dos Santos, Andre Arlovsky, and Dan Lambert. This will be, I think, Arlovsky's first match, Dos Santos' second match, and the first time we're seeing Dan Lambert wrestle. I think he's probably in there to take the losing fall, because I have the Inner Circle winning this thing. And that's my guess, is that it'll be the old fat-faced dipshit, Dan Lambert, taking the L for his team. Bryan Danielson one-on-one against Miro in the finals of the World Title Eliminator. I was looking forward to Moxley and Danielson, but I'm also looking forward to this. Because Miro has been on fire since he dropped all the video game, kind of goofball comedy stuff. And the way they booked him as TNT champion, the way that they've done these vignettes where he's sort of questioning God and almost threatening God in these promos. Why have you forsaken me? All of a sudden now, with the Moxley situation, it's like, well, he lost the TNT title. One door closes and another one opens. I think he and Danielson are going to have a hell of a match. Their first time in the ring together in 3 years. They had a King of the Ring qualifying match on SmackDown that Miro won clean over him. Believe that might have been their only singles match. So I think it's going to be a very good match. I'm going with Miro. And I might be going against the grain here. I don't know. I would think Danielson would be the favorite. I'm going with Miro. And I'm going with Miro largely because of what I think is going to happen in the main event. The main event being Hangman Adam Page challenging Kenny Omega for the AEW World Championship. It was 1 year ago at Full Gear. These two got in the ring together as friends. Omega won in the finals of the World Title Eliminator and ended up winning the championship on TV a few weeks later from Jon Moxley. That was the Winter is Coming show. So here we are 1 year later. It has brought these two men back together, although under very different circumstances. Omega's the heel. He is the world champion, defending now against Hangman. I have been waiting very patiently for this Hangman story to play out, and now the time has finally arrived. The only outcome here that I want to see is Hangman Adam Page beating Kenny Omega to become the new AEW World Champion. The guy is over. He is very popular. The fans want to see it. They've been waiting patiently for it. I would hate for this to be one of those times where you wait just a little too long and you cool the guy off just a little bit. You know, not unlike what they did with Naito in New Japan a few years ago, where I think a lot of people felt like they waited just a little too long, Ghetto did, to put that championship on him. But I think they're going to do the right thing here. I think Hangman is going over. I think he's going to win. And if he is going to win, and only if he is going to win, I think he's going to kick out of the One-Winged Angel. That is, they've done a very good job of teasing it out, not having anybody else in the company kick out of that move. If this is Hangman's night and they're putting him over and he's winning the championship, then Omega should hit the One-Winged Angel and Hangman should be the first man in AEW to kick out of it. So if Hangman wins the title, this is why I like Miro winning in the Eliminator, because it gives Hangman a strong heel to wrestle and to beat in his first title defense. Or maybe they get a couple of matches out of it. But I think Miro wins, Hangman wins the title, and he's got his first challenger already set up. So that's your Full Gear card as it currently stands. Very strong card on paper. On paper, it's even stronger, I think, than All Out. But I think we'll have one or two matches, including whatever Cody is going to be doing, added to the show this week. Other news and notes. Former WWE star Angelo King Kong Mosca passed away yesterday after a long battle with Alzheimer's disease. This according to a statement by his wife Helen on her Facebook page. He was 84 years old. He played football before he wrestled. He was good enough to be drafted by the Philadelphia Eagles back in 1959. It was the year that my mother was born. But he had already committed to playing in the Canadian Football League, which is where he went to go play. And he was later inducted into the Canadian Football League Hall of Fame. He made a reputation for himself as a tough player, which carried over into his wrestling career. He wrestled all over Canada later on for the WWF before transitioning into the announce booth for a couple of years and then retiring in the mid-80s. But he was no slouch. I mean, this guy wrestled Bob Backlund for the WWF Championship, Harley Race for the NWA title, Nick Bockwinkel for the AWA title. Mosca was a star. About 10 years ago, he famously got into a fight. And I had forgotten all about this, but when I heard that he died and I was reading up on him, I was reminded of the incident with Joe Capp. Joe Capp was a quarterback in the CFL back when Mosca was playing. And the two of them attended a luncheon for CFL alumni. Again, this is going back a decade. Cap was on stage. Mosca was then introduced, and he was being helped up onto the stage. There's video of this entire thing on YouTube. It went viral at the time. You just type in, you know, Angelo Mosca incident, or it should be the first thing that comes up. But Cap brought a little branch, like an olive branch, with him to extend to Mosca because there had been a lot of bad blood there for almost 50 years. I think mostly from the Joe Cap side about what had happened, because I guess Cap thought was a dirty hit by Mosca took place in a game that they were part of back in 1963. That was the year Kennedy got shot. And apparently he was still harboring a lot of ill will for this perceived dirty hit in that one football game. So Cap is there. He's got an olive branch that he is offering to Mosca. And Mosca gets up on stage, and Mosca, they put the mic in his hand, and as he's getting himself situated and sitting down, he sees him trying to extend this branch to him, and he tells him to shove it up his ass or some such thing. And everybody laughs. It's almost like a comedic moment. Well, Cap walks over and he starts waving it around in Mosca's face. He's got this branch and he's sticking it in his face. Now, Mosca's an old man. I mean, they're both old at this point. Mosca's 74 years old. He's got a cane. He swings his cane and he clips Cap right in the face with it, knocks his eyeglasses off. And Cap walks over and he punches Mosca right in the jaw. And then down goes Mosca. Everybody gasps. People rush over to help him, make sure he's okay. At that age, I mean, you could break a fucking hip. I mean, it's like grumpy old men come to life. Remember Walter Matthau, Jack Lemmon, right? I mean, that's like the real life version of this. Only these two really don't like each other. But I remember Mosca went on the Dr. Phil show after his book came out, and Dr. Phil brought up the incident and played the video because Dr. Phil's a little shit stirrer. After 50 years, I think it's time to let it go at that point. I saw video of this supposed dirty hit. Didn't even look that dirty to me. So I don't know what his issue was. But I could see Jim Cornette, you know, 50 years from now, taking a swing at Kenny Omega with his walker, if Omega ever came within 10 feet of him. Cornette would be about 110 years old at that point. After yesterday's New Japan Power Struggle show in Osaka, the 2021 G1 Climax winner himself, Kazuchika Okada, challenged Buddy Matthews, the former Buddy Murphy in WWE, to a match. Matthews is scheduled to make his New Japan debut this Saturday in San Jose at their Battle in the Valley show. So how's that for a debut, to be challenged by one of the greatest of all time? You're coming in, your very first match, even though it's on American soil, your very first match working for New Japan, and you get challenged by Okada? Probably the greatest champion of our generation. But that means Okada is going to be back on American soil. For how long, I don't know. Might he be able to squeeze in an AEW appearance at some point, depending on how long he's going to be stateside for? Maybe to even just to tease a future match. Battle in the Valley is on the same night as Full Gear, though. So if he does show up as a surprise in AEW, it will not be on this pay-per-view. This pay-per-view is in California, and Full Gear is in Minnesota. So it will not be happening on Saturday. At that Power Struggle show in Osaka, Kenta defeated Hiroshi Tanahashi to win the IWGP United States Championship, and El Desperado beat Robbie Eagles to win the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title. It sounds like some of the COVID-related restrictions may finally be easing up in Japan, so hopefully that means easier travel between the two countries without every promoter having to worry about their guys needing to quarantine for days at a time, and hoping that also the fans are going to finally be able to start cheering and booing again at the shows and not be restricted to just clapping their hands, which they clap their hands real loud. They clap their hands like a group of seals, but it doesn't replicate cheering and booing. And a lot of these New Japan shows, especially in these big buildings that are half empty because they have, you know, attendance restrictions on them, it's just not good. It doesn't sound good when you have people clapping but not allowed to cheer. So I'm hoping now that as things improve, maybe that'll start to change as well. Now, I want to talk to you guys for a minute about protection. I'm not talking about carrying protection like Dirty Harry, or even the kind of protection you might use with your girlfriend. That's a whole other kind of sponsor. No, think about your smartphone. That's a $1,000 device that you carry around with you every single day. You probably have a protective case for it, right? I mean, I do. Because you know that the one time you go without one, you're going to drop it and you're going to wish that it was in that protective case. I speak from experience on this, and it sucks. It's a terrible feeling. That's what going online without ExpressVPN is like. Every time you connect to an unencrypted network, whether it's at a hotel or an airport, maybe even a friend's house, your online data is not safe. Any hacker on that network can gain access to and steal your personal data. That includes your passwords and your financial information. It doesn't take a genius to do it. A 12-year-old with access to Google could do it. And if they do, they can make a killing selling your information on the dark web. So why do I use ExpressVPN? Because it's encrypted and it's secure. It would take a hacker with a supercomputer over a billion years to get past ExpressVPN's encryption. And we'll all be wiped out by then by Mother Nature anyway. It's also incredibly easy to use. Just fire up the app and click one button. That's it. That's all you have to do. You got a phone? You can use ExpressVPN. You got a laptop? You can use ExpressVPN. You've got a tablet? Guess what? You can use ExpressVPN, which is great because even when you're on the go, you can take ExpressVPN with you. I like it because I can browse with peace of mind, and that's important to me. I don't need the stress of worrying about every site that I visit or every pop-up I accidentally click on where it might be taking me or if any of my personal information is being stolen. So if someone ever tells you, oh, that's the internet, there's not much you can do about it, that person is an idiot. And they clearly never used ExpressVPN before. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster. And you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/solomonster. Raw this week was carried by the action in the ring, and it made the show go by a little bit quicker than usual. Becky Lynch is still the Raw Women's Champion with a win over Bianca Belair. 18 minutes they gave them, so there was no swerve. They delivered a very good match. Belair used a press slam and tried a moonsault, but Lynch got her knees up, and Lynch followed that with a manhandle slam. But Bianca got a rope break at two. She came back with a glam slam for another one, and Bianca got Becky up on her shoulders for the KOD. But Becky yanked off the top turnbuckle as she was struggling not to go down with this move. She yanked off the turnbuckle pad. She slipped out and she pushed Bianca into the exposed buckle and then rolled her up while hooking the tights for the win. So Becky had to cheat to win because she's a heel, even though she got a lot of cheers at the finish. Because again, people really don't want to boo this woman. They'll go along with it if you force them to, but they really don't want to boo this woman. So now we know it will be Becky Lynch against Charlotte Flair at Survivor Series. There's a fresh match we've never seen before. What isn't as clear is the direction for Bianca Belair going forward, because now she has lost yet again. She lost to Becky in 26 seconds at SummerSlam. Let it play out, they said. Then she failed to win the title at Extreme Rules. Let it play out, they said. Then she lost at Crown Jewel. Let it play out, they said. She had a great match on Raw with Charlotte and again failed to win the championship. Let it play out, they said. Now she lost on Raw to Becky. This feels a lot to me like the Rhea Ripley push, where she got to hang with the top names for a little while before being kind of demoted down the card. That is the fate that likely awaits Bianca Belair. It has officially played out, and it played out the way that I figured it would. You can give her all the outs you want, all the excuses. Oh, she cheated to pin Bianca. Becky did this. This person did that. What people remember is that she lost. She failed. Again and again and again. But what she's proven is that she can have great matches with all four of the horsewomen. She had a great match with Sasha Banks at WrestleMania. She had a very good match with Bayley at Hell in a Cell, and had Bayley not gotten hurt because they needed her to go do roles at the Performance Center, I think she and Bianca would have had a great I Quit match at Money in the Bank. She had a great match on Raw against Charlotte, and she's done great work with Becky Lynch. Bianca is the real deal. But losing the way that she did at SummerSlam and failing time and time again to win her title back does not do her any favors. Austin Theory had a good match with Rey Mysterio. He picked up another win. The man is on a roll so far. But before the match, Kevin Patrick was in Gorilla in the back interviewing Rey and Dominic Mysterio. Theory showed up. He said that he would take a selfie with Rey after he beat him. Dominic told him to show some respect, and then the two went out to the ring, right? Their music hit, so off go the Mysterios. At which point, the camera pans back and shows Kevin Patrick standing there in the most unnatural, ridiculous position. He was squatting like he was trying to take a shit. Very clearly, because they told him to, because one of their directives is that they don't want their announcers or their referees to appear taller than the talent on screen. Which begs the question, if it bothers them so much, why not just hire smaller announcers? And the camera didn't even like cut away quickly or anything like that. It lingered on him standing there like that, completely embarrassing him. He looked completely ridiculous. Dominic struck Theory in the face before Rey hit the 619, which the referee saw, and he disqualified Rey for his son's action. So the story is that Dominic cost his dad the match. And now both of them are going to be on the same Survivor Series team, and I'm going to run down the Survivor Series news here in a second, so I'm sure that story is going to play out even more at the pay-per-view in a couple of weeks. Kevin Owens raised some eyebrows in a promo segment with Big E and Seth Rollins. E wanted to defend his WWE title against Rollins later in the show. Seth said he wasn't 100% after the ladder match last week where he won the contract for a title match. Oh, I'm sorry, title opportunity. I'm sorry. 10 demerits for me. But that's when Owens interrupted. He called himself the face of Monday Night Raw. Rollins may have won the match, but he said all anybody was talking about was my performance. And I'm just sitting here listening to this, thinking, who cares about your performance? You lost. You fucking lost. You didn't win the contract. Why are we supposed to care about his performance? This is one of the reasons Kevin Owens is in desperate need of a heel turn. The Kevin Owens of old would not be out there talking about what a great performance he had. It would be about winning and losing. But he has a new t-shirt to sell that says, just keep fighting on it. So I get it. They have to sell t-shirts. They have to get that idea over. But he made the comment, it might be 3 more months or 3 more years, but every time I'm on Raw, I'm going to give the fans something to remember. So he's out there teasing the end of his contract, playing off the rumors. Again, the end of his contract is believed to be on January 31st, at which point he would be free to sign wherever he wants and show up wherever he wants to. There would be no non-compete if his contract expires. Of course, if they wanted to really be cold and fuck with this guy, they could release him a few days before his contract expires. So that way, his 90-day clause kicks in and he couldn't go anywhere until May. Owens then suggested a first-time-ever match between him and Big E, which Big E accepted. So we got our main event set. Good thing they didn't already have a main event planned on this show. Boy, are they lucky. One of the more unexpected little delights of that show on Monday night was a first-time encounter between Finn Balor and Chad Gable. They had 5 minutes to show what they could do together, and I would love to see them get double that one day. The only thing that makes me sad is that I remember how into Gable people were a few years ago when he was in that King of the Ring tournament. He went on a run of wins in that tournament until he lost to Baron Corbin in the finals. Even Baron Corbin, I remember being really good in that tournament, and Gable brought the best out of him. But the people were into him. Now he's a heel, so I get that, you know, they're not necessarily going to cheer for him, but they just didn't care about any of this. They didn't care about any of his near falls in this match, which is a complete reversal from just a few years ago. But I mean, if you really stop and ask yourself, Why would they? Why would they care? They haven't been given a reason to care about this guy. He worked over Balor's ankle. There were some great counters and reversals in here. He gave Balor a superplex off the top rope, but upon landing, Balor immediately cradled him for the win. So hopefully not the last we have seen of these two in the ring together. This was very good for the time that it lasted. Continuing on that theme of good matches, we had Damian Priest and T-Bar. No disqualification, but not for the United States Championship. That name is the last living vestige of Retribution. I hope they let it fade away soon, like the rest of that group, and let Dijak have a fresh start. The man can go, as he showed here. This was good stuff from these two. Dijak got Priest tied up in the ropes and grabbed a kendo stick. He started wailing away at his midsection. Priest couldn't do anything to protect himself. Almost instantly, you could see the welts forming across his stomach. Priest freed himself. He turned Dijak inside out with a clothesline, and then he grabbed a chair. And he had this crazed look in his eyes before he started destroying him with this chair. He chokeslammed Dijak from the ring apron through a table down below. Then he dragged him back inside. He hit the reckoning for the win. I hope this opened some eyes in the back, including one pair of very old eyes, the ones with cataracts in them, about Dijak and the fact that he's a guy with size who could be doing more than they have him doing and contributing more than they have him contributing at the moment. Apollo Crews came out when the match was over with Commander Aziz and cut a promo on Priest, teasing his next feud. So this may be the end with Priest and T-Bar, but rather than see him on the unemployment line next year, the next round of cuts, they need to have him come out on TV tomorrow and shed his Retribution skin. You know, Mace is actually a decent name. I have no issue with Mace keeping his name on SmackDown, but T-Bar has got to go. And they need to give him something to do. They're running vignettes for fucking Veer. Before they released him, they turned Keith Lee into a cat. They got rid of Karrion Kross. It would be very easy for Dijak to be left behind. But he deserves better than that. Owens and Big E ended the night the way it began, with a good match. It's really what carried the show this week. And the finish was interesting. With Rollins at ringside, he got involved and nailed Big E when the referee wasn't looking. This was after E and Owens had bonked heads. And Owens clearly saw what Rollins did. He saw Rollins reach in and clock Big E. And he tried to take advantage anyway by going for the pin, but the champion crucifixed him over and pinned him. Now on the replay, Big E saw that Owens saw what Rollins did. Owens grabbed the mic and he started apologizing, claiming he didn't know. He blamed Rollins for causing all this trouble and called him a stupid son of a bitch. He challenged him to a match tomorrow night, and then again turned to Big E and apologized. E wasn't buying any of it. He hit Owens with the big ending, which was less a heel thing to do and more a case of him simply not trusting Kevin Owens, which he has every right not to do. There was a time when Kevin Owens was not somebody to trust here on this television show. He turned on his best friend his very first night in the company. Why would you trust this guy? I like the fact that Big E was not succumbing to dumb babyface syndrome here for a change. I would have dropped this guy where he stood too. Finally, a babyface with balls and brains. All of this felt like the start of a Kevin Owens heel turn. Even if he leaves, and I don't know why he wouldn't, even if he leaves, there's no harm in turning him now and getting a title match out of it against Big E before he walks out. But I like the little bit of intrigue there at the end. I can't imagine Owens is going to be very happy about apologizing and still being laid out for it. So this was a more tolerable episode of Raw than usual because of the matches. And that was with some people missing. No AJ Styles, no Bobby Lashley. Edge is not there all the time. The matches carried it. The in-ring work carried it. But matches are not enough to carry the show every week. I agree with the people who say it can't always be about work rate. You're right. Some of the most fun periods of time in my wrestling fandom, it wasn't just about work rate. There was something else. There were stories or characters or promo work or other things coupled with the work in the ring that made it fun. They just can't seem to find that good mix right now. So thank God we have shows on some weeks where at least the in-ring work gives us something to cheer for. Because were it not for that, boy, this show would be in even worse shape than it's in right now. In-ring work is not enough. You need interesting stories. And that's just something they don't have a lot of right now. Now, I know we have a lot of sports fans out there, and some of you also may be into sports betting. And if you are, then you know how quickly the lines can change. I'm probably not as experienced at it as some of you are, but I know enough to know that when you've got a lot riding on those odds, you want to make sure you're plugged in and have all the information you need to stay ahead of the curve. So before you place those bets, make sure you listen to The Daily Tip, presented by BetMGM, for the best betting analysis that you can find. Michael Jenkins and Chelsea Messenger host The Daily Tip. They break down the big takeaways and make sure you're up on everything you need to know to bet smarter. I was just listening to them the other day, in fact, when they were talking about the Packers and the whole Aaron Rodgers fiasco. They're fun to listen to, kind of like two friends chatting. And they bring guests on the show as well, like bookmakers, Odyssey insiders, and BetMGM experts, so you always get different takes on the action and strategies. If you start listening to The Daily Tip each day, your friends are going to start wondering what you know that they don't. As much fun as it is to bet on the game, it's even more fun when you've got the inside scoop. Ready to bet with an edge? Tune into The Daily Tip, presented by BetMGM. Listen weekdays 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern on Odyssey, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Friday on SmackDown, Roman Reigns was back from his one-week vacation where he said he was frolicking naked on his private island, and his wife was loving it. What he didn't love is that the Usos lost to the New Day last week, and this all led to Sir Kofi and King Woods coming out to set up the main event between Xavier and Jimmy Uso, where Woods said if he won, Jimmy would have to bend the knee to King Woods, but if he lost, Woods would have to acknowledge the tribal chief. Roman had a great line to the back later when he said, "I take 1 week off and SmackDown sucks. It's almost as bad as Raw." Now, what's really sad about that, as much as SmackDown sucked without him on the show last week, it wasn't much better with him on it this week. And it is almost as bad as Raw on some weeks. So it's nice of them to acknowledge that, even if it is just to give Big E something to respond to tomorrow night to set up Survivor Series. But it hits differently when you know what the man is saying is true. At least if it wasn't true, you could chalk it up to Roman Reigns being a delusional heel. But there's nothing delusional about what he said. Naomi picked up a win over Shayna Baszler with a roll-up, but Sonya Deville came out and noted that there was a spot where there should have been a rope break, and there wasn't. So she restarted the match, which allowed Baszler to put her in the Kirifuda clutch and choke her out for the win. We got a Xia Li vignette and a Ridge Holland promo in the back talking about how he can't wait to meet his idol, Sheamus, the man who beat John Cena for the WWE Championship, the man who once won the Royal Rumble match, the man who once cashed in his Money in the Bank on Roman Reigns. Sheamus has been out recovering from surgery on his broken nose. A little odd for Ridge Holland all of a sudden to be such a huge Sheamus superfan, but him against Holland sounds stiff. I like it. If it were me, though, you know, Drew McIntyre has been doing these open challenges on TV every week since coming over to SmackDown. I would have built it up to Holland accepting 1 week and then beating Drew McIntyre. Right away, it puts him on the map that he beat a former WWE champion. But Sheamus is also a former WWE champion, so it could still happen. They recapped the angle last week before with Charlotte Flair, Shotzi Blackheart, and Sasha Banks. And Shotzi's supposed heel turn, even though she was a babyface who attacked a heel after being screwed out of a win. She gave the same speech she gave on Talking Smack about losing tag team title opportunities that she was supposed to have, and losing her tag team partner, and losing the support of the WWE universe, which is always just such a cringy thing to say. Takes me right out of the promo every time. She says she's going to run over anyone in her way, including Sasha Banks, and she doesn't need a tank to do it. I was just saying on the Rampage stream on Friday night, before I even saw this segment, I had watched part of SmackDown, but I didn't see this segment yet. And somebody asked me something in the Super Chats about Shotzi, and I said, watch, they're going to take her tank away from her soon. Like, they strip away other NXT stars and things about them that worked in the past. You watch, they're going to take that tank away from Shotzi. Now, look, I never really liked the tank gimmick anyway. I thought it was goofy seeing her ride down to the ring in her little toy tank firing Nerf missiles at people. But that was her thing. And already, sure enough, it sounds like the tank may be no more. Angel Garza and Humberto Carrillo are now going by Los Lotharios. They picked up a win over Cesaro and Mansoor. I like the pairing on Raw of these two, and I like it on SmackDown also. I think they make a good team. They too, like so many before them, have now had their last names chopped off. If you go to WWE.com, Angel Garza is now just Angel, and Humberto Carrillo is now just Humberto. Ricochet accepted Drew McIntyre's open challenge this week and had about as good of a 3-minute match as you're going to see, with the second greatest Claymore kick that I have ever seen. The one that he hit Brock Lesnar with to eliminate him from the Royal Rumble last year was more satisfying. But here, Ricochet went for a moonsault, and as he was coming down, Drew caught him right in the face with a Claymore kick for the win. Very similar to the brogue kick that Sheamus used to beat Matt Riddle at WrestleMania. Riddle also was coming off the ropes, I think, for a springboard moonsault, and he got booted right in the side of the head. And also very similar to the super kick that Ricochet himself ate in NXT, upside down from Adam Cole. It's just a great spot. Not too many people could pull off the timing of it just right, but Ricochet now has done it twice. Both times on the receiving end of that kick. But they really need baby faces on SmackDown right now, and Ricochet is somebody they really could use in that spot. So it was a good showing for him here, but if you really want to get him going and heat it up as a babyface, he's got to start appearing each week, and he's got to start winning matches. Now with B-Fab fired, they already took her voice out of the Hit Row entrance song. Boy, that didn't take very long. It's just, it's not the same. It's just not. It's not the same without her there. They did some comedy where Sami Zayn offered to show them how to do a proper entrance, where he then proceeded to enter to his new theme music and dance to it, if you can call that dancing. Hit Row praised him at first, then started mocking him, and then did their "if you didn't know, now you know" line to wrap up the promo. Yeah, if you didn't know WWE would find a way to screw all of this up, now you know. That shouldn't be Hit Row's signature. It should be the new signature at the beginning of the show every week. If you didn't know, now you know. King Woods picked up the win over Jimmy Uso in the main event after Woods rolled him up. Jay tried to help Jimmy win, but the referee saw it, and that gave Woods the opening to roll him up. I guess even Kings win their matches with distraction roll-ups. Jimmy was about to bend the knee to the King when Roman Reigns attacked Woods. Bloodline beat down the New Day, forced Woods to watch. The Usos attack Kofi's leg with one Uso locking on a half crab. The other one delivered an Uso splash to the other leg. This felt like a way to write Kofi off TV for a few weeks, especially since Woods has already been announced for a match at Survivor Series and no Kofi. Reigns told Woods he would show him what a real king looks like next week. That sounds to me, if I had to venture a guess, that sounds to me like a match that might end with a Xavier Woods win when Big E invades SmackDown and costs Roman the match, non-title obviously, to put some heat on their own match at Survivor Series, which I have to think is going to be announced this week. Speaking of Survivor Series and various announcements, we finally have some matches announced 2 weeks before the pay-per-view. Pay-per-view is supposed to be such a big deal. It's Raw versus SmackDown. And how did they announce these matches? Why, they randomly threw out a bunch of names on Twitter for the men's and women's elimination matches. No storyline set up, no qualifiers, nothing at stake, as always. You know, there's a reason why the Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, Money in the Bank, and SummerSlam are all stadium shows now. and Survivor Series is not. Because you're not filling up a stadium or a dome with 40 or 50,000 people for a show like this. Representing Monday Night Raw for the men will be Seth Rollins, Finn Balor, Kevin Owens, Rey Mysterio, and Dominic Mysterio. Literally every single member of Team Raw was a member of the SmackDown roster a little over 2 weeks ago. All they did was change the color of their shirt. It's basically Team SmackDown against Team SmackDown. My bold prediction is that SmackDown is going to win this year. They take on Drew McIntyre, Jeff Hardy, Xavier Woods, Sami Zayn, and Happy Corbin. On the women's side, representing Raw, we have Bianca Belair, Rhea Ripley, Liv Morgan, Carmella, and Queen Zelina. Taking on Team SmackDown, led by Sasha Banks, Shayna Baszler, Shotzi Blackheart. Boy, Sasha, Shayna, and Shotzi. Try saying that five times fast. Natalya and Aaliyah, who has yet to wrestle a single match since being drafted, although she did finally make an appearance backstage on Friday night, talking to Jeff Hardy. Aaliyah is on Team SmackDown, while Toni Storm continues to twist in the wind. Naomi, at least, I can understand. Some people, when I mentioned that on Twitter, threw Naomi in my face. But I can understand that Sonya Deville doesn't want her in the match. So, like, storyline-wise, you could say she kept her out. At least Naomi has a storyline. At least she's on television. That's more than I can say for Toni Storm. It looks even worse now that they gave away the bloodline against the New Day on Raw all those weeks ago instead of saving it for this show like I was hoping they would. But the seeds were planted on Friday for the Roman Reigns Big E singles match. You know, Roman took that little dig at Monday Night Raw. And his beating down the other members of the New Day, I would imagine we'll be hearing from Big E going off on Roman Reigns tomorrow night. NXT could be on the verge of losing two of its top babyfaces next month. I'm going to talk about that later. NXT TakeOver may be dead, but there will be some sort of NXT special airing on Sunday, December 5th, the first for this new 2.0 version of the brand. This, according to Brandon Thurston of WrestleNomics. Now, he has asked around to see if they will continue to use the TakeOver branding. He has not been able to get an answer. I think they should just call it something else. TakeOver is dead. I don't want to see the name associated with whatever the hell this show is supposed to be now. They changed everything else about it. They may as well change the name, too. So I'm hoping we get something other than an NXT TakeOver. This week was the worst of the 2.0 era so far. They have turned NXT into a variety show. This is their version of Saturday Night Live. And like modern-day SNL, it is rarely funny. I don't know if it's purely a Vince McMahon-Bruce Pritchard thing, or if this is Shawn Michaels' influence, since he's taken over with Triple H being out. I mean, if it is his influence, it's quite a contrast from Triple H's version of NXT. Although there is more of an emphasis on promos than there was before. Now, I don't know if, again, that could just be a general directive about the new 2.0. Or maybe the change in the show in that regard could be credited to Shawn Michaels. That I don't know. But it's a very, very different show than it was even 2 months ago. Mandy Rose, the new NXT Women's Champion, was in the ring for a promo. They cut to the back. They showed the other members of Toxic Attraction beating down Zoe Stark. That was to explain away a legitimate knee injury that she suffered in the ladder match at Halloween Havoc, which she will be undergoing surgery for shortly, per the Observer. Io Shirai came out to confront Mandy, and she got triple teamed by Toxic Attraction until Casey Catanzaro and Caden Carter made the save, which sets up a six-woman tag match this Tuesday. It's like I said last week when someone asked me if I thought there would be more female factions or another female faction that rises up to fight, you know, Mandy and her girls. I said no. What we'll get is a loose alliance of babyfaces trying to take them down, and that's exactly what we got here. We had vignettes throughout the show from Duke Hudson's Poker Palooza, I guess you would call it. He was in his poker room somewhere. Cameron Grimes showed up. And when all of this was over, he had beaten Hudson, who got very angry, and he flipped over the poker table. That's really all that happened here. This is just to build to an eventual match between the two of them. Dakota Kai got a quick win over Cora Jade and threatened to jump off the ring apron down onto a table that she had draped across her after the match. But she had second thoughts and let her live. Her head was twitching. She was making these deranged facial expressions like the devil in her head was telling her to do bad things, but she resisted. She looked conflicted. It was an interesting little twist on her persona as she prepares, I would assume, for an eventual rematch with Raquel Gonzalez after costing her the women's championship. And then we got whatever the hell this was with Zion Quinn and Robert Stone. Quinn has been the silent badass so far in what few appearances he has made on this show. So he got to show off some actual personality here. And I thought he was fine. But this entire segment was pure cringe. Maybe that could be the name of the next NXT show. Instead of calling it TakeOver, we can call it NXT Pure Cringe. He chokeslammed Robert Stone, who was dressed as Elvis, on the Halloween Havoc show in the back a few weeks ago when they were having a costume party. So this week, Stone challenged him, but first he was going to out-sing him. And he sang and he danced poorly. And then it was Quinn's turn. He started singing and dancing to Shawn Michaels' Sexy Boy theme. He started singing to Shawn Michaels' theme music. I've got the looks that drives the girls wild. I've got the moves that really move them. I send chills up and down their spine. The whole thing he was doing here. And at one point, when Stone came after him, he continued to sing, and he dipped him, Dirty Dancing style. This was a segment straight out of Raw, and I don't mean that as a compliment. Quinn did squash him at the very end, and he pinned him. I don't have an issue with him showing some personality and not being so one-dimensional, but this was fucking terrible. Legado del Fantasma picked up a nice win over the most awkward couple since Maurice and Ted DiBiase Jr., Kyle O'Reilly and Von Wagner. They were about to go for a double team finish. It looked like Wagner hit the ropes to go for something, but as he came off, Raul Mendoza caught O'Reilly with a missile dropkick, and Joaquin Wilde schoolboyed Wagner for the win. I just can't with these two. I just can't. This pairing is death. Absolute death. Bron Breakker. Finally, some life on this show. Bron Breakker, coming off his loss to Tommaso Ciampa, got a bounce-back win over Andre Chase. After the match, he admitted that he lost the biggest match of his career last week, and nothing pisses him off more than losing. Boy, I wish everybody on the main roster felt the way that this guy does. But he gave Ciampa his props and said that he was the man in NXT, and that he would come back and win the title. Simple and effective. Backstage, the new NXT Tag Team Champions Imperium were cutting a promo in German with subtitles when they were interrupted by the Women's Tag Team Champions Gigi Dolin and JC Jane, who said they were booked for a trios match next week and that the guys should watch them. And as they walked off, Marcel Bartel in German, again with subtitles, said, "The ring may be sacred, but America has its benefits." He's a horny devil, this one. Couldn't take his eyes off them as they walked away. I don't blame him. It's only a matter of time before this show is sponsored by Blue Chew. We got another pre-taped edition of Lashing Out with Lash Legend with Tony D'Angelo as her guest. He intimidated her producer, Mark, into saying that everything is fine, even though his arm was in a cast, having obviously been assaulted by this man and locked in that car trunk. He said his goal is simple. It's to make as much money as he possibly can and beat up some people in the process. He name-dropped Dexter Lumis, Johnny Gargano, Pete Dunne, Tommaso Ciampa. And then he said he's got a call with Vito and Secaucus. And he slipped Lash some cash before dashing off. I think I got an email once from Vito and Secaucus. I think he sent in a mailbag question. Solo Sikoa got his first win in NXT, a good old-fashioned squash win over Jeet Rama, who was released 2 days later. I got serious Umaga vibes from Sikoa, right down to the running butt splash in the corner. And of course, he won with the Samoan splash off the top. I think it's your birthright. If you're from that family, you have to be able to hit a top rope splash. Unless you're Yokozuna, that would have been attempted murder. Or murder. What am I saying? Attempted murder. Attempted. He does a top rope splash when he was at his, 650 pounds. There ain't no attempted there. At that point, it's just called murder. I'm very bullish right now on Bron Breakker, Carmelo Hayes, Tony D'Angelo, and Solo Sikoa. They've definitely got a few diamonds in the rough down there right now. We got a promo with the NXT champion Tommaso Ciampa, who was interrupted by the North American champion Carmelo Hayes and Trick Williams, who were out there for their main event match against Johnny Gargano and Dexter Lumis. He talked about how it's not about old school like Ciampa anymore, but the new school like him, which he is the leader of. And Ciampa laid out Trick with a right hand. I like the back and forth with Ciampa and Hayes. Hayes is a total star. I said it the first time I saw him, even before the breakout tournament. And the heel turn only cemented it in my mind. And as Ciampa was leaving, Gargano made his entrance and the two of them crossed paths. And they eyeballed each other before the commercial break. The match itself was good. It was at its best when Gargano and Hayes were in there together. Lumis got his sleeper applied on Hayes. Williams, on the outside though, hit Lumis in the head with his shoe. And Hayes came off the top rope with a diving leg drop right across the back of the head and got the pin on Dexter Lumis to win the match. I mentioned earlier, two top NXT stars may be on their way out of the company, out of the promotion. Johnny Gargano is one of those stars. His contract is said to be expiring on December 3rd, and there has not been any news yet of him signing a new deal. My guess is that he will. You know, his wife also works there. But if he does leave, that run in with Ciampa, that little run in they had in the aisleway, is all the more interesting because you would think that they would want to do one more match between the two of them before Gargano leaves. And the time to do it would be that December 5th live special, even though it's 2 days after his contract reportedly runs out. You know, they did reach a deal with Adam Cole to stick around beyond the expiration date of his contract and extend things out a little bit more. So they absolutely should do it. If he does decide to leave, they should do that match and have him put over Ciampa on the way out. The other name whose deal is set to be up next month, according to PW Insider, is Kyle O'Reilly. Kyle O'Reilly is a rudderless ship in this new NXT. He does not fit. Bobby Fish is a veteran pickup for AEW, but as a single, my question with Bobby Fish has been, what do you do with a Bobby Fish? He came in, he's already wrestled Danielson and Punk and lost. If he stays as a single, you know, wrestler, what do you do with Bobby Fish? The thing to do would be to put together a Red Dragon reunion. AEW has a very robust tag team scene. They would be right at home in that division. The ball is in Kyle's court. He could choose Von Wagner, or he could go a different way. I know what I would do, but I'm not the one making the decision. Gargano and O'Reilly both were at SmackDown on Friday night in the opening dark match. Gargano beat O'Reilly. Sounds more to me like two guys whose deals are coming due and they want to get a look at whether or not they think it's worth it to keep them around. That's what I get the sense of here. I can't think of all these cuts that we heard about this week inspiring a whole lot of confidence if I'm Johnny Gargano or Kyle O'Reilly. The minute that Vince McMahon and Bruce Prichard got a look at Gargano, you know they started plotting the return of Cedric Von Hausen, the champion of Liechtenstein, which is how Gargano debuted on SmackDown many years ago when he was still a nobody, and he showed up 1 week to wrestle MVP. Kyle, I mean, my God, they'll bring him in as Dr. Lyle. What was that name he used in those vignettes with Undisputed Era, when Roderick Strong was traumatized by Dexter Lumis Kyle disappeared for a while, but then he reappeared as like a doctor. Dr. Lyle O'Thurstenberg or something. That'll be his new gimmick on TV. Jerry Seinfeld already stole Dr. Von Nostrand. So Dr. O'Thurstenberg is going to have to suffice for Kyle O'Reilly. That is his future if he sticks around. If you have questions for the mailbag, you may submit them to thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. We can't have a 14-year anniversary show and not do some good old-fashioned mailbag questions. I got a good one here, too. One that I think is going to be very beneficial to people who don't know how ratings work. Chelsea in Chesapeake, Virginia. Whenever I hear people talk about TV ratings, I'm not entirely sure how many people a rating corresponds to or what a share is. Can you explain what these things and what the demos mean and why they are so important? The Hollywood Reporter had a great write-up on this a few years ago that I remember I bookmarked it because there's a lot of good information in there. This may have changed since then a little bit, but those Nielsen numbers that we always hear about are based on a sample. No different than a political poll where they survey a small number of people. Usually they do it by phone to see, you know, who they're going to vote for or what a person's stance is on certain, you know, social issues. And then all the cable news channels run with it and you ask yourself, well, how is a poll of 100 people or how is a poll of 500 people or 1,000 people representative of millions of people? It's a sample. Nielsen numbers are based on a sample of 40,000 homes and about 100,000 people that they think best represent the population as a whole. Because not every home in America is a Nielsen home with a little Nielsen box, you know, tracking their viewing habits. When you hear that Monday Night Raw got a 1.7 rating, the rating is a percentage. It measures the portion of a group that is watching that specific show. Maybe it's the overall rating. Maybe it's the ever-popular 18 to 49 demo. Maybe it's men 18 to 34. It's women 50 and up. Whatever it may be. 18 to 49 is the main group that advertisers look at, and they set their ad rates accordingly, which is why it's so important to TV networks. So when Raw got a 0.39 rating a few weeks ago in 18 to 49, 0.39 is what they got. That was its lowest 18 to 49 number in the history of the show. This show has been on television since 1993. And a few weeks ago, they got their lowest 18 to 49 demo number ever. 1 point in that demo is, or was, as of a couple of years ago, about 1.28 million people. So if Raw only got an 0.39, that's not even a full point. You can do the math and figure it out. It's never been my best subject. But if a show did a 2.0 rating in 18 to 49, then the number of people in that age range who watch that show would come out to a little over 2.5 million people. The share that you sometimes see listed for a show next to the rating is the percentage of a group of people watching television at that time that are tuned in to a given show. So when Raw had its biggest ratings ever, unopposed to Nitro, which was preempted for the NBA that night, the show did an 8.1 rating. That was in May of 1999. Monday Night Raw did an 8.1. But they also got a 12 share, which is insane. That is absolutely insane. That means that 12% of everybody who was watching television in this country during those hours that night had their television set tuned into wrestling. So I know it's not, even with this explanation, it's not necessarily the easiest stuff to follow, but hopefully that gives you a little more clarity on what some of those terms mean. Lewis from Hinckley, UK. With everyone being released from their Ring of Honor contracts and the company seemingly coming to an end, what do you think of AEW putting on an ECW one-night stand type of show for ROH? It would be a great send-off to the company that is responsible for some of AEW's top stars like Bryan Danielson and CM Punk, and a great way to introduce other talents like Bandido and Jay Lethal. Maybe that could be the show where we see Danielson against Punk for the first time in AEW, would love to hear your thoughts. I think it is very premature to even be talking about something like that. First of all, everybody is still under contract. They will not be under contract as of January 1st if their deal expires at the end of this year. Anybody who has a deal that expires after January 1st will stay under contract until about April. So even though, yes, everybody is basically going to be free of their contract soon, that hasn't happened yet. And even though I look at this as the end, I mean, this is the end of Ring of Honor as we know it. I think the qualifier there is as we know it. The Ring of Honor that you knew and I knew no longer exists. What this new Ring of Honor is going to look like, when and if they come back, nobody knows. But they insist that they're coming back in April. So AEW is not going to go out and do some kind of Ring of Honor tribute show when Ring of Honor claims they're still coming back. They just might not be, you know, they're going to be a very different type of company. Whether you believe that or not, we'll have to wait and see. But it would be very, very premature for AEW to even think about doing something like that. Christoph from Belgium, am I wrong to assume that Tony Khan may be the reverse Vince McMahon in terms of how they handle talent? Vince was always known for pushing bigger men while smaller guys had a tougher time breaking through. Yet with Tony Khan, it seems quite the opposite. Guys like Cage, Wardlow, Lance Archer, and even Miro never really seem to get a big push, while a guy like Darby is constantly beating men twice his size. Do you think this is a fair statement? I mean, I think in that one respect, yeah, you could say that Tony Khan is like a reverse Vince McMahon. He's like a bizarro Vince McMahon. I also think you just look at the AEW roster and you can see. I mean, the majority of the people on their roster are not physically big people like some of the names that you mentioned. That's why Wardlow and Brian Cage, Lance Archer, they stand out more because they don't have a lot of people on that roster that are as physically big as them. A lot of that roster are smaller, kind of junior heavyweight type of guys. And Vince McMahon has a lot of smaller junior heavyweight type of guys on his roster. But his inclination has always been to push the bigger kind of, muscular guys who look like stars. When you look at them, they just look like a star. They're walking through an airport, you would stop and say, hey, who's that guy? That guy looks like someone special. That guy looks like a wrestler. That guy looks like a bodybuilder. We hear about these directives from time to time that they give to developmental where it's like, well, we're only looking for people from now on who are 6'2", 240 pounds. And usually these edicts don't necessarily stick for too long, but how many times have we read about that over the years? How many times have we heard from people who were there at the time who say, yep, that sort of thing does happen? They have a certain type that they look for. That type does not exist in AEW. Now, whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing is entirely up to what your personal taste is in pro wrestling. Carlos from Gaithersburg, Maryland. I came across an interview where David Benoit talked up his potential ring gear, which had his last name on it. Clearly, he is not responsible for what his father did, but his last name is now infamous in the wrestling world. I can't imagine WWE ever signing David to a contract, but do you envision another promotion like AEW or MLW signing him? Personally, I think it would be a public relations nightmare, especially when you consider the disturbingly huge swath of Chris Benoit fans who seem hell-bent on trying to convince the public that his in-ring achievements are more important than the unforgivable crimes that he later committed. But it's also not David's fault what happened. What say you? It is not David's fault what happened. I feel really badly for him. I do think that the fact that he looks so much like his father is unnerving to a lot of people. But that shouldn't necessarily prevent him from getting a shot. Now, he's not going to get one in WWE, but do I think an MLW or some company could give him an opportunity? I think they could. If he's insistent that he wear, ring tights similar to his dad and he puts the Benoit name on them, if I'm a promoter, I get it. I get it. That would give me pause. I'd say, look, listen, I might be willing to give you a shot here, but maybe ditch the tights and wear something different. Or I don't know. I can understand where a promoter would be coming from, but I agree. It's not his fault. I think if he really is that serious about wrestling, he just needs to get good at it first. And I haven't kept up with his training, if he is still training or if he slacked off on it and isn't training anymore. He has to put the work in like everybody else and find a school or some person who wants to train him. And if he is at a good enough level to hang with other people who have more experience at this, then I think some company out there at some point should give him a look and give him a chance to get in the ring and see what he can do. Last I heard him in an interview, you know, he didn't sound like he was really actively training full time. And I don't know if he has taken it seriously where he's been training this entire time or not. I have no idea. I know there are people, family members, Hart family members, who I think offered to train him and wanted to see him do well. But I wouldn't sign him just to give him a chance because of what his last name is either. You know, he's got to train like everybody else. And if he's not good enough, then he shouldn't get an opportunity. But if he puts the work in and somebody watches him wrestle and says, holy shit, this kid's got a knack for this, he's pretty good, then yeah, I think at some point somebody ought to give him a look. But I completely understand if a promotion is hesitant to do that, especially if he's insistent on using the Benoit name and dressing up like his dad and wearing the same kind of tights his dad wore. I get it. You know, what he did is, you know, unforgivable. And it's hard to separate that from his wrestling career. I can go back and watch Chris Benoit matches. I have no issue doing that. Some people can't. I totally get it. But that's very different than, you know, him going on television and actively paying tribute to him. It's his dad. He can pay tribute to him in private all he wants to. If you run a wrestling company and have television, is that the sort of thing you want to put in people's heads, though, and remind them of this horrible thing that occurred with this guy all those years ago? So it's a tough situation to be in. It's the son paying for the sins of the father. Jason from Sacramento, in 2003, when Kane unmasked on Raw, was that to pop a rating? If not, why did they unmask him? And do you know what the ratings were for Raw that night? The unmasking was Kane's idea. He has said that he and Vince McMahon were the only two people in favor of doing it. He thought that he had gone as far as he could go in the mask, and it was stifling his creativity. I think they also wanted a big main event because they were in Madison Square Garden that night. So with him wanting to do it, the timing just made sense. And I had to look it up. The show did a 3.9 rating, which actually was considered disappointing for a big episode like that. Imagine a 3.9 being disappointing for Monday Night Raw. That main event popped a 5.0, by the way. So if you have questions for the mailbag, you know the drill. You know where to reach me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I love hearing from you guys. I am thinking right now, because we did this last year. We did a separate kind of anniversary live stream on YouTube and hung out and answered your questions. So I'm thinking about doing the same thing. We'll have maybe a more formal 14-year anniversary sound-off stream. Not this week, but next week on Thursday, November 18th. So circle that date on your calendar, probably 8 p.m. or so. We might do an anniversary stream. I think what I might do also is incorporate some Survivor Series predictions into it as well, because that's a few days before Survivor Series. So maybe we'll do like a combo predictions and your Q&A and celebrate 14 years of the Sound Off, as we are doing here this weekend, as we are doing really all month long, celebrating 14 years of this podcast, 729 episodes, although it's been a lot more than that. When you factor in all the extras and everything else from over the years, it's well over 1,000. But 729 episodes of this podcast, and I want to thank everybody at the end, as I did at the beginning, for supporting the show, whether it is, you know, monetarily, whether it's just spreading the word among friends and sharing links when I ask, you know, people to share links on Twitter, to bring in new fans of the show, becoming a channel member on YouTube. We've had an influx of new channel members, and you get some perks on there and bonus content that nobody else does. So it's just very cool to get that kind of love from you guys. And hopefully year 15 will be even bigger than year 14. We're going to have to really pop off for the 15-year anniversary next year. I better start thinking of ideas. There is also, by the way, a 14-year anniversary t-shirt that is available on prowrestlingtees.com/solomonstersoundsoff. So you can get it in black, you can get it in white. Thank you to Steve Mello for his help in putting the design together. But that is on there for people who are interested. I'm going to be back live with you on YouTube this Wednesday after AEW Dynamite, the go-home Dynamite to Full Gear. I will not be live on YouTube on Friday for Rampage because I will be out at the House of Glory show this Friday, November 12, bell time 8 p.m. in Queens, New York at the NYC Arena. You can watch it live on Fight TV. If you are not able to get tickets or you are not local and you want to watch the show or hear me on commentary, whatever it may be. It's been a while. Probably a little rusty. It's been 2 years, but I am very happy and very excited to see House of Glory back. They've already announced their next show. I think December 11th, I believe, is the date. That's a Saturday. So not only do we have the Born Again show this Friday, but we've already got the next one lined up. So I'm ready for that. Tune in, and maybe I'll see some of you live in the building on Friday night. You won't be able to miss me. Trust me. When you see me, you will not be... They'll be able to see me from space. You will not be able to miss me on Friday night. And I'll be back with you next Sunday for episode 730 of the Solomonster Sounds Off. So until then, be well, stay safe, and I will see you guys back here for more Sound Off as we do it each and every Sunday. And I thank you all for the love and support. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Keith Lee, called up to the main roster as Keith Lee. Beat Randy Orton as Keith Lee. He was in the Royal Rumble as Keith Lee. He was at the Survivor Series as Keith Lee. All of a sudden, one day, we'll put claws on his tights. I'll make him scream and squeal when he goes down to the ring, and I'll make him scratch himself and lick his own ass. I'm a Bearcat.
Oh, it's a Keith Lee tribute to Bearcat Wright.
It was nonsense from the moment I fucking heard it. Give me a fucking break.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter at Solomonster.
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 Put that cigarette out.
Solomonster Sounds Off.